Right, good morning, ladies and gentlemen, those who are here in person and those who are here on the Zoom. Those who are physically present and only virtually present. Today's show might be slightly less energetic than usual without a decaffeinated cheer this morning, so it feels a little bit different. But on the other hand, we have balloons, so that sort of raises the level of celebration here a little bit. We're still with the Maharal of Prague on Purim, on the subject of Purim and the subject of Megillas Esther. I have a couple of dedications to make. The Ilui Nishmas, Miriam Bas Avraham and Shem Tov Ben Shlomo, and another dedication in memory of Henry and Wendy Breacher, Chaim Yitzchok Elia Ben Zaev and Sarah Pesalea Bas Yitzchok, who have sponsored these shiurim. And I'm very pleased to be here once again. And we're going to be looking at Megillas Esther. If I'm not mistaken, the shiur that just came before here was on Tanis Esther, about Tanis Esther, one of the more obscure Tanaisim, probably the most obscure fast day in the Jewish calendar. I mean, the other four Tanaisim fast days of Tisha B'Av and Shavuos B'Tammuz and Asara B'Teves and Tzom Gedalia were all fast days which are mentioned clearly, have clear sources, and were all instituted in commemoration of the Churban, of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Tanis Esther doesn't have a source in the Talmud at all. Right, and my speculation is, you know, we've learned here in this shiur for a few weeks, we looked at Rav Yosef Karo, who was in fact a contemporary of the Maharal. Right, Rav Yosef Karo was sitting in Tzfat, and the Maharal was sitting in Prague in the 1500s, and at the same time. And Rav Yosef Karo, of course, writes the Shulchan Aruch, and we spoke about the fact that Rav Yosef Karo, really, by writing the Shulchan Aruch, he standardized Jewish practice. This was in many ways a great gift to Klal Yisrael, who had been really came from various different places in Morocco, Algeria, North Africa, and in Spain, Portugal, and in Ashkenaz, and in Tzfat, and in Israel. They were really, lots of the communities were a mix of different minhagim and different views, and he felt that Klal Yisrael was going to disintegrate in many ways. So he wrote the Shulchan Aruch to standardize it. This Tanis Esther is a good example, because Tanis Esther is a fast day which really was not a standard practice in Klal Yisrael. It was really adopted by different communities and for different reasons, based on different opinions. But once the Shulchan Aruch wrote in his text, we fast on the 13th, right, of Adar, because it's Tanis Esther, that's it. It became a standard practice. So that was one of the expressions, really, of the power of Rabbi Yosef Karo in the Shulchan Aruch. Created a social reality of Tanis Esther. Okay, let's have a look at the Maharal of Prague. Just to remind you, you can see your sheet in front of you is the timeline and a very short bio of the Maharal of Prague, who very much, single-handedly, pretty much, established a Torah center in Prague and lived pretty much for the whole century, the whole 16th century. He lived to be close to 100, the whole 16th century, and wrote extensively. As I mentioned to you last week, he wrote extensively, mainly about Midrashim and mainly about Agadot, explaining the thinking of Chazal at a deeper level and introducing certain mystical, Kabbalistic elements into his thinking. But also the Maharal was somebody who understood about science. He lived in the Renaissance period of science, and he knew many of the Renaissance scientists of his period, and Prague itself was a center of Renaissance art and science and study in the 1500s. And in that sense, he also created a type of Jewish life, which was lasted and created a very strong presence in Europe for many centuries. As you can see here on this timeline, I just want to touch upon two things here which we didn't look at last week. You can see I bring in the sheet it says his disciples. Can you see his disciples? So he had many disciples. He had a yeshiva and he was a teacher. And if you're teaching Torah for nearly a century, there are quite a few people who have learned Torah from you, right? But two of them are really dominant figures in Torah literature and in Jewish history. The first one is Rabbi Yontef Lipman Heller, H-E-L-L-E-R, right? And in fact, he launched a whole... a rabbinic dynasty of Rabbi Hellers. There are Rabbi Hellers all over the world, right? The name Heller became associated with rabbinic positions. If I'm not mistaken, he had 16 children, which helps. If you want to establish a dynasty, that certainly is a good way to get it launched, you know. And Rabbi Yontef Lipman Heller took over from the Maharal of Prague as the chief rabbi of Prague, right? So he was his Talmud, and he was, what he's famous for is his commentary on the Mishnah. Nobody had really written such, shall we say, a broad range commentary on the Mishnah. And the reason why he wrote a commentary on the Mishnah is because his Rebbe, the Maharal, was a great advocate of the study of Mishnah. And people used to say, well, we're going to learn Mishnah, but if you just learn Mishnah without the Gemara, it can be a little bit boring because you don't get into, really, the questions and answers and the analysis of the concepts. So he wrote a commentary, which today, if you buy in the shop a standard Mishnah, right, the commentary of what's called the Tosfot Yontef, the Tosfos Yontef, is a standard commentary on the Mishnah, which goes back to Rabbi Yontef Lipman Heller in the 15 and 1600s. What he writes is a continuation of the Maharal. He didn't fight all the Maharal's battles. The Maharal, he disagreed with his teacher on certain issues. Maybe now is not the time to go into it. But it's very interesting to see this actually in Torah literature, that even though you have disciples of great teachers who are dedicated followers of their teacher and hold them in the highest esteem, nevertheless, they disagreed with them on certain issues. They felt themselves able to debate and to disagree with their teachers. And this is a sign, really, of the robust, if you like, intellectual honesty of Torah scholars throughout. And in one of the commentaries, it's very interesting, in the Pirkei Avos, it speaks about the relationship between the Rebbe and the Talmud. And in one of the Mishnayos in Pirkei Avos, it says, "Veheve misaveik ba'afar raglehem." You should sit at the dust of their feet. Let avek comes the word avak. Avak means dust, right? But Reb Chaim Volozhin writes that the lit avek has another meaning as well. And that lit avek also means wrestling. In fact, in modern Hebrew, the wrestling sport is called hit avkut, right? It's called lit avek, means, so what Reb Chaim Volozhin says, you should indeed sit, so to speak, at the dust of the feet of your teacher, but you should also wrestle with him. In other words, you should also take issue with him if you feel that your sense of the MS gives you a different idea than his. You have to say it. You shouldn't simply absorb the teachings uncritically. And this is a feature of Talmud Torah, which is extremely important. And you find that with Rabbi Yontef Lipman Heller vis-a-vis the Maharal, and also the other very prominent Talmud of the Maharal was Reb Shai HaLevi Horovitz, known as the Shlo HaKadosh. The Shlo HaKadosh is known as the Shlo Shin Lamed Hei, because he wrote his magnum opus was the Shnei Luchot HaBrit, Shin Lamed Hei, Shnei Luchot HaBrit, which runs to four or five volumes and is an extensive work combining halachic, midrashic, and Kabbalistic material in a very beautiful and original way. And again, Abishai Halevi Horowitz drew his inspiration and his learning from the Maharal of Prague. So I just gave you two examples, really, of how the Maharal's teaching going forward went into a European Jewry in a very very big way. Okay. So if you look in the major writings, the last part of the sheet in front of you of his biography, you will see that item 8 is a book called Or Chadash, which is dedicated to Purim, which is the book I have here in front of me here on the desk, Or Chadash. And basically in Or Chadash, he goes through the Megillah, chapter by chapter, pasuk by pasuk, and gives us collections of various midrashim and statements in the Gemara, and gives us a new appreciation of the language, the concepts, and of the period of the Mordechai and Esther story. So we're all familiar with the story, but what I want to do now this morning really is look at one particular extract of the story. If you turn over to the second page, turn to page 2 for a minute. These are photocopied on both sides, so this is on the second side of the first sheet. And let's read a few psukim here. The story here on Megillas Esther chapter 4 picks up the narrative. Let's just give a context here for a minute. The narrative is that Esther has been abducted and kidnapped, so to speak, and taken into the king's palace, into his harem. And the king, and she finds favor in his eyes, but she doesn't disclose that she's Jewish. So she is sitting in the king's palace for years, wondering, why did God do this to me? Right? Why am I here, kidnapped and married to a non-Jewish king who himself is not such a nice person anyway? But in any sense, that Esther Hamalka, I want you to get a bit of context here. The woman herself, Esther, is a woman who Chazal understood to have a woman with Ruach HaKodesh. The fact that Chazal agreed to accept Megillas Esther into the Tanakh means that they gave it their, what's a good, their seal of approval. They gave it their seal of approval. That the Tanakh is not a book of short stories, right? And particularly, Megillas Esther is a strange book. If you compare it to other books in the Tanakh, right? In the Tanakh, there are 24 books. And you compare it to the other books in Tanakh, you'll find something very weird, actually, about Megillas Esther. The first thing is, it contains no miracles. There's nothing miraculous happening there. Not only that, it contains no prophecy. There's no nevuah, right? It never says anywhere God spoke to Mordechai or to Esther. They are not nevi'im. Not only does it contain no nevuah, it contains no malachim either. Don't forget, if you look in the book of Daniel, so the book of Daniel also, Daniel is also not a novi, doesn't have nevuah, but he has regular conversations with Gavriel HaMalach, with the angel. The angel Gavriel comes and communicates with him. So he has, shall we say, divine communications. None of that happens in Megillas Esther. So there's no prophecy, there's no miracles, there are no angels. And most surprisingly, what else is missing from Megillas Esther? There's no name of God. The name of God doesn't appear. So if you take all those things together, combine it with the fact that it was written by a woman. Now today, being written by a woman is not a negative issue, but if you go back into antiquity, into the ancient world, not only in the Jewish world, but in the non-Jewish world as well, the idea of an authoritative book written by a woman was unheard of. Even in England, even in the 18th century, women authors, if they wanted their books to be published, had to take on men's names, right? They had to pretend to be men in order to get their books published, because no one would publish a book written by a woman. It was unheard of, it was unthinkable that anybody could consider a book written by a woman to be authoritative, right? And indeed, none of the books of the Tanakh are written by women, except for Megillas Esther. So Megillas Esther is in a class of its own in many different ways. And there are all these would-be reasons not to include it in the Tanakh. Are you following me? There were lots of very, very good reasons. If I was sitting on the board of management, right, discussing should Megillas Esther be included in the Tanakh or not, right, I could imagine that the conversation was, look, it's a lovely story. It's a fascinating story, and it's got a happy ending, and it's a wonderful example of God helping the Jewish people. But as a Kitvei Kodesh, don't forget what the Tanakh is. Tanakh is Holy Scriptures, right? Tanakh is Kitvei Kodesh. So Chazal said, no, Esther was writing with Ruach HaKodesh. Esther had a level of spiritual inspiration which qualified her to write a book included in the Tanakh. The Gemara actually relates a whole debate between Esther and the committee for canonizing Jewish scriptures. I'm not quite sure what their acronym was, what the committee. But Chazal say this was actually the job of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. Right? The Anshei Knesset HaGdola, this is the period of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. This is the period of a group of people who were all connected together, even though many of them lived in different countries. Daniel lives in Bavel. Ezra moves to Israel, and Mordechai is in Shushan. But they are all members of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. And according to the Gemara, in this group of 120 people called the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, also includes the last three Nevi'im, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, are all members of this group. So this group is quite a formidable group of Talmidei Chachamim and Jewish leaders spanning about a century or two, right? After the Churban of the first Beis HaMikdash, and going into the building of the second temple, the second Beis HaMikdash, that's the period of Anshei Knesset HaGdola. And the head of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola was Ezra. We'll speak a bit more about Ezra later on. I call upon him, this was a moment when they had to decide, that this is when the Tanakh was closed, so to speak. It was the last date of entry. Yes?
We learned in the show before this that according to the Chachamim,
yes,
Zechariah lived before Esther.
Yes, quite
so
right.
How can he have closed the Tanakh?
Okay, so it was a period of time. It was a whole period of time, right? That Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi were part of Anshei Knesset HaGdola, but it spans one or two centuries. So some of them lived in the early part, some of them lived in the latter part. But one thing is clear, that by the time you get to the end of the period of Anshei Knesset HaGdola, right, you're then into the beginning of the period of the Mishnah. The Mishnah begins where Anshei Knesset HaGdola leave off. You following me? And at that point, we already have a Tanakh, a completed, what the Goyim call a canon, right? A canon of holy scriptures, and Esther was just at the closing date, right? They were just closing the Tanakh, right? And Esther sort of came in under the wire, so to speak, right in the very last moment, and she writes a letter saying, Kitvuni ledorot. Write this down, please. This is the Megillas Esther. Write this down. And some said yes, some said no. In the end, as you know, Esther is one of the five Megillot. And we're going to be reading it this week. And it's a masterpiece, absolutely magnificent piece of text. And it's written with Ruach HaKodesh. So here's this woman, gifted with a great spiritual soul, Ruach HaKodesh, spiritual soul. But she's married to this non-Jewish king. And in fact, she remains married to him her whole life. She's locked in. She has been captured by the emperor, and she is one of his wives, and she has no choice in the matter. She's been abducted. But she must have been asking herself, and certainly Mordechai, who was her uncle, asks himself every day, b'chol yom v'yom, the Megillah says. Mordechai mishalech, Mordechai is going back and forth in front of the Chatzar HaMelech, ladat mazev al mazet, to try and figure out what's this all about. How could it be that such a great woman as Esther is locked up for years in the most unbelievable circumstances? There must be a purpose to this, right? And of course, part of the story is that eventually becomes clear that she is the solution to the problem. Okay, that's what we're learning now in chapter 4. What's happened here is Haman has given out his edict of genocide, that he is lahashmid larog ul'abein es kol ha'yehudim, right? The earliest, if you like, formulation of what we know from the 20th century to be what was called the final solution, right? To make the world free of Jews. Haman was the first man to articulate that. Sadly, and ironically, it's still, that message is still coming out of the same country where Haman originally said it from, right? From Iran. Haman and Mordechai and Esther lived in Persia, which is today called Iran, right? And Iran is the only state on planet Earth, the only state on planet Earth which as part of their national policy is the eradication of the state of Israel off the face of the earth.
Only states, not only people.
What do you say?
Only state, not the only
Yes, exactly right. Of course, there are anti-Semites and there are anti-Israel and there are Hamas and terrorists, but there isn't another state, there isn't another official state in the world who has as part of their national policy the eradication of the of Israel and the destruction of the Jewish people. So they are still really, when you read the Megillah, you shouldn't think that Haman is ancient history. Haman is still alive and well living in Iran. Okay, the son of Esther is an interesting topic for a whole different shiur. Esther having a son does not appear in Megillas Esther anywhere. Doesn't appear in Megillas Esther anywhere. Well, all we do know is that once Ahasuerus died, his successor is someone called Darius. And Darius is very sympathetic to the Jewish people, and he promotes and funds the building of the Second Temple and the return of the Jewish people to Israel, right? There was a tradition among Jewish scholars, including Rashi, that Darius was the son of Esther, and Ahasuerus, right? So Esther living with Ahasuerus, it makes sense that she should have a child, and it makes sense that her child should be the next emperor, right? So that was Darius, according to Rashi. Again, it's not mentioned anywhere in the Tanakh that Darius was the son of Esther, but that seems to have been a tradition among Rashi and his followers. Hakol ponim, that we know about, that Esther did have that continuity. Anyhow, the point here is that the Jewish people are under threat of genocide, right? And the question is, how are we going to solve this problem? Mordechai, as the leader of the Jewish people at that time, decides that he needs to go and speak to Esther and convince her that she should solve the problem. Let's have a look at a few psukim together, shall we? On page 2, ladies and gentlemen. Vayomer Mordechai, Lashibel Esther. Mordechai sends the following. He couldn't actually physically talk to her. He only did it through a messenger, through an emissary. He talks to Esther. Ve'yamar Mordechai lo shivel Esther. He sent the following message to Esther: Al tadami benafsheich. Don't imagine for a minute lihimolid beis hamelech mikol ha'yehudim that you will survive. If the Jews are killed, you shouldn't think that you will survive. In other words, it will include you as well. He wants to tell her that, look, she might be a queen in the palace, but if Chas v'Shalom, the massacre takes place, she herself will also be included in it. And then he says to her this magnificent pasuk, one of the most magnificent psukim in the whole Megillah. Listen out for it tonight and tomorrow morning when you hear the Megillah. Listen out for this pasuk, because he says, Im hachareish tacharishi ba'es hazos, if you are silent now and do nothing. So Mordechai says to her, "Revach v'hatzala yamud la'yehudim mimakam acher." We will solve this problem without you. We will solve this problem without you. But va'atu beisovich tovedu, you will be lost. In other words, you now have an opportunity to redeem yourself. Here you are, a spiritual Jewish woman married to a non-Jewish king. Not of your choice, but nevertheless, that's where you're locked into. To redeem yourself, you've got to make use of your unique position in the palace. And then he says to her a rhetorical question, which is a rhetorical question that many people throughout the centuries often ask themselves: Umi yodea im la'es kazos higat la'malchus? Who knows? Maybe this is the reason why you're here. In other words, we don't know why God put you in this situation and has given you, on the one hand, great fame and power and access to the royal throne. On the other hand, you're locked in to this non-Jewish king. So, who knows, he says to her, who knows whether maybe this was the reason why all this has happened to you in your life, but now's the time to make use of it. What's interesting here is that Mordechai is very confident. I spoke about this, I think, if I'm not mistaken, last week. How come is Mordechai is so confident that Revach v'Hatzala yamad l'Yehudim u'mokamacha? If I was speaking to Esther, I would have said something else. What would you have said if you were speaking to Esther? I would have said to her, if you don't help us, we're lost. We're finished. I would have thought that's more of a convincing argument, right? In actual fact, he says to her, if you don't help her, don't worry, we'll manage without you. What he's really saying to her, listen to this, what he's really saying to her is, we don't need you, you need us. In other words, you need us to justify your life married to a non-Jewish man, right? You need to do something now, and that will justify, that will redeem you. You need to redeem yourself, right? But if you don't do it, you shouldn't think that that we will be massacred. We won't, right? How did Mordechai know this is an interesting question. I'm not going to go into that exactly at the moment. But what's also one of the interesting things I said a few moments ago, that one of the hallmarks of Megillas Esther is that the name of God is not mentioned anywhere. But look at this pasuk. What does it say in this pasuk? Where is the name of God in this pasuk? So the Mefarshim say that Mordechai is saying, Revach v'Hatzala yamod la'Yehudim mimakom. Hamakom yirachem aleinu. Hamakom is a hidden reference to the Shem Hashem. Doesn't say anywhere any other of the explicit names of God, but Hamakom. Right? HaKadosh Baruch Hu will solve this problem somehow. Mordechai says, I don't know how. He'll solve it problem. Revach v'Hatzala yamod la'Yehudim mimakom. He was already promised that the problem would be solved. We'll put that aside for the moment. So he convinces her that she needs to act. And what he says to her is, I've edited this out a little bit to get it on just one page. He says, you've got to go to the Ahasuerus and you've got to throw yourself at his feet and you've got to beg for mercy, right? Esther says, no. That's not the way to do things, right? Why does she not want to beg for mercy from Ahasuerus? Because she knows that Ahasuerus doesn't have any mercy. He doesn't have that faculty in his personality. He is a man completely, totally absorbed in his own power and wealth, and more than that, his own pleasures. Don't forget, if you read the Megillah properly, it starts off with a feast, a royal feast of 180-day feast, right? Rabbi said, you've been invited to various dinners and bar mitzvahs in your life, okay? And even if they're very magnificent, my guess is you have never been invited to a 180-day. What do you eat on day 93? Do you know what I mean? What do you eat? What do you eat? What are you supposed to do in a 180-day feast? But clearly, it was meant to show the enormity of his wealth and to celebrate personal pleasure and hedonism. And just to enjoy the eating and drinking. And then, of course, what does he do after that? He captures all the beautiful women in the country and takes them one by one, takes them for himself and puts them in his harem. So he's completely involved in self. He's simply involved in his own pursuit of pleasure. He's a Baal Ta'ava of the highest degree, and he's not sensitive to, and when Haman says, let's kill the Jewish people, he basically says, yes, get on with it, gives him the green light. He's not interested. So Esther understands that the only way to change the mind of Ahasuerus is pressing another button. You can't press the button of mercy or kindness or empathy, because that button has been disconnected a long time ago. Right, you've got to know which buttons are active, right? So the only button that she can figure out to press is the button of either fear or jealousy, right? So jealousy is really, according to Chazal, that's what she understood. We have to make Ahasuerus jealous. If we make him jealous, then we can somehow get under his skin. And how do you make him jealous? So Esther makes him jealous by doing what? By inviting him and Haman to a private, intimate little drink. She invites them, in England, what you'd call, you invite them for tea. That's what you'd say in England. But maybe in other cultures, she invites them for a mishte yayin. But it's an intimate little gathering. She doesn't throw a big party. She says, I'm only interested in the company of you, my darling king, and Haman. And he's thinking, what's going on here? Why is she inviting Haman to an intimate moment? Right? The Gemara actually says, a very interesting, based on various different understandings of the text, what was her strategy? What was Esther's strategy to get rid of Haman? Right? So you'll see in a minute, let's have a look at the next pasuk. So the next pasuk contains some very powerful themes, and I want to have time still to read what the Maharal says, but let's first have a look at this next pasuk. Vatoma Esther v'lahoshev Mordechai. Esther replied as follows. Everybody with me? Leich. She says to him, go. And it's interesting that Esther is giving him instructions. In other words, Mordechai is not only instructing Esther, but Esther's also instructing Mordechai. And you can see the last sentence on the page is, Mordechai did as Esther had commanded him. Do you understand? So Mordechai clearly respects Esther's view. She's not just somebody who he tells what to do. He also receives from her instructions, which is very interesting. She says to him, Leich, go, kenos es kol ha-yehudim ha-nimtzoyim b'shushan. Gather all the Jews of Shushan. V'tzumu olai, and fast for me. In other words, I'm going out there to try and save the Jewish people, but I need that the Jewish people should fast for me. V'al tochlu v'al tishtu, not to eat and not to drink. Shloshes yomim laila v'yom, for 3 days. V'gamani v'narasai otzum kein, and me and my servants will likewise fast. U'v'chein ovoy el hamelech ashelo kados. I will then go to the king ashelo kadat. What did she mean, ashelo kadat? Any offers on this? What does she mean? I'll go to the king ashelo kadat.
Not according to the rules.
What were the rules? That's right. The rules were that you only came to speak to the king if he invited you. If the king summoned you, you came. You couldn't knock on his door and say, I've come for a chat. Didn't work like that. So she was going to go, Asher lo kados, was against the rules of the king. The kasha ovadati, ovadati. This is probably one of the saddest moments of the whole Megillah. The kasha ovadati, ovadati, and if I'm lost, then I'm lost. Right? And you can see here from this word that she had at the back of her mind that possibly this is a suicide mission of hers. That she's going into it and she might not come out of it. That's always very gripping moment. If you listen to the reading of the Megillah by someone who really knows how to read the Megillah, there aren't many people actually who really know how to read the Megillah. There are people who know how to pronounce some of the words, but the reading of the Megillah properly is to say these two words, v'kashe, ovadati, ovadati. How are they laid? Yes, they're laid with an eichonigan. V'kashe, ovadati, ovadati. And if I'm lost, then I'm lost. Right? What did she mean by that? Akasha, ovadati, ovadati. So the Gemara suggests that what was Esther's plan A, which Baruch Hashem she did not need. She didn't need her plan A. She actually used her plan B. But her plan A was she would invite Haman and the king to a second party, and at that party she would make a fake confession. We all know what's fake news, right? We live in a generation of fake news. But she would make a fake confession. She would, in inverted commas, confess that she was having an affair with Haman. And then the king would have no choice but to execute both of them. And that would be the end. And with that, she'd solve the problem. That was her plan A. She was able, and she could use the jealousy of the king and her position as the king's favorite wife, she could use that by sacrificing herself, and that's what she meant. Kasha ovadati, ovadati. If I die, then I die, but I will die in the service of saving Am Yisrael. In the event, she didn't need that strategy, but that was her plan A. That was her strategy, which could easily have worked. That could have worked, right? If she wouldn't have had any other possibility, that would have worked. But what's interesting here? Okay, so now I want to have a look a little bit at the Maharal, because the Maharal is interested in this pasuk: Lech kenosus kol ha'yudim ha'nimtzayim b'shushan. Gather all the Jews in Shushan. What does it mean, kenosus kol ha'yudim? There's something going on here. There's a backstory here, which is of extremely significant meaning. What is the lech kenosus? So turn now, please, to page 3 for a minute. So this is the Maral Or Chadash. I can't really do justice completely to this text. Also, I've edited it a little bit for our purposes of this Shia. There's a lot more material on this. Bear in mind, right, again, what I mentioned earlier, that we're dealing with this period in history, which is the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, right? And the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, they have introduced into Judaism quite a few mitzvot derabanan, quite a few. So for example, I just want to give you an example before we look into this. For example, if you look in the Rambam will tell you that until this period of history, let's say roughly, take a rough figure, from the beginning of Har Sinai until Ezra is roughly, give or take, 1,000 years. Roughly. It's approximately 1,000 years. For the first 1,000 years of Jewish history, right, there was always a mitzvah of tefillah. There was a mitzvah of davening, okay? Because that's written in the Torah, to daven to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Question is, what did you say when you davened? What was your text? And the answer is, there was no text. Everybody just expressed their own feelings, their own ideas. They addressed God. They stood up every morning in their backyard or in their front yard or in their lounge or in their kitchen, and they stood and spoke to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and davened to Hashem, saying whatever they felt was appropriate for them to say. Right? When Ezra and Anshei Knesset HaGdolah came along, they decided that going forward, that's not going to work properly. Because most of the Jews live in the Gola, in the exile. Some are in Iraq, some are in Iran, some are in Egypt, some are in Europe. They all speak different languages. They won't know how to do this. So guess what? What we're going to do? We're going to write the Siddur, what we call the Siddur, right? What we call the Siddur, which is the fixed text of Tefillah, was written by Ezra and the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. They all participated in deciding on the, like they decided on the final text of the Tanakh, they also gave us the Siddur, right? And they also decided that the Siddur should be in Hebrew, right? In fact, it's probably true to say that the single most powerful initiative to preserve the Hebrew language in the Jewish people was the writing of the Siddur. Because before that, everybody was davening in their own language. You could daven in Egyptian language, you could daven in Yiddish, you could daven in Ladino, you could daven in whatever language you wanted to daven in, until Ezra said, here it is. These are the brachas. This is the Shemona Esra. This is the way to daven, right? The earliest text about what you should say when you daven was, of course, the Book of Tehillim. The Book of Tehillim predated the Siddur. Right? But why was the Book of Tehillim written? Because it was little paragraphs of tefillot that had been authored by various individuals, edited by David HaMelech and put together in the book of the Sefer Tehillim, 150 chapters of tefillot. Why was it necessary? Because there was no Siddur. So if you wanted to express a particularly powerful idea, you memorized or you wrote down one of these Tehillim, and that was your davening. Right? So the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah gave us a new structure to Jewish life. And two of the most prominent things they gave us was the Tanakh and the Siddur. But now the Maral is going to speak about the third most important innovation of that period. Let's have a look, ladies and gentlemen, let's have a look at the text. Lech kenosus kol ha'yehudim. Esther tells Mordechai, go and gather the Jews together. Dovol zeh. This statement, says the Maral, Romzor loy al hatafilo. She wasn't talking about kenos, gather them together to have a drink together, or gather them together in order to sing together. He says, gather them together in tefillah, she yispalalu, that they should get together and daven, uvedovo zeh shayach leich kenos. The words leich kenos have a particular meaning. Exactly why and how the Maharal deduces this is something beyond the scope of this shir. But in the word Leich Kenos, he understands this is a gathering of people who are joined together in tefillah. Kasha yelchu lebeis haKnesset lispalel. They should go to shul, the Beit haKnesset. And I want you to pay attention to the words here. We call our shul a Beit HaKnesset, which is surprising. Because we should really, I would have thought, it was up to me, I would have called it a Beit Tefillah, a house of prayer. Ki Beisi Beit Tefillah Yikari Lekol HaAnim. Yeshaya refers to a place of prayer as a Beit Tefillah. Why do we call it a Beit? What does Knesset mean? Knesset just means a gathering. People who get together to watch a football match are in a state of Knesset, if you like. Right, Knesset just means to get together in some sort of joint enterprise. Right, the Maral is telling us that actually the word Beit HaKnesset is connected to this pasuk in Megillas Esther chapter 4, Leich Knos et Kol HaYudim. When he said Knos, it means get them together, that they kasha yelchu leBeit HaKnesset lispalel v'lo yitpalel kol echad bebeito. That they shouldn't daven everyone in their own house like they've been doing for 1,000 years. Raktia tefillat hatzibur. What is the Maral referring to here? That it was at this period in history. It was Mordechai, Ezra, and the Anshe Knesset Gdola who instituted this very, very powerful new halacha, which had never existed beforehand, which was tefillah b'tzibur, that you daven with a community. We'd never heard of that before. People have been davening since Avram Avinu, since Adam Arishon, people have been davening to God. That wasn't the Chiddush. The Chiddush was to daven as part of a tzibur that was a new halacha, which was instituted mid-Rabbonon, right? The obligation to daven with a community is of rabbinic origin, dating back to when? The time of Megillas Esther. Megillas Esther gave, of all the gifts Megillas Esther gave us, apart from things like Haman Tashen and getting drunk and various things like that, right? One of the gifts is Tefillah B'Tzibur. And Esther says to Mordechai, what we need now is sort of not just a Tefillah, but Tefillah, a turbocharged Tefillah. How do you turbocharge Tefillah? You get together in a shul and you daven B'Tzibur. That amplifies the passion and the motivation and the quality of one's davening. And look at these first three lines of the Maral, very, very powerful. Because she was telling him, Leich Kenosas Kol HaYehudim, this is an expression of the Beit HaKnesset, of the gathering place. Of course, in modern Israel, they've pinched the word Knesset for the government, right? The government sits and they call it the Knesset. And the truth is, in terms of Hebrew language, they're not wrong. Knesset just means people who get together. So it could mean people who get together to legislate, or people who get together to yell at each other. There's more yelling going on than legislation, I think. They get together to yell at each other, to curse each other out, but they get together, it's a Knesset. And incidentally, the reason why there are 120 seats in the Knesset is because of the Anshe Knesset HaGdolah, who had 120 members. That's where it comes from. That's the origin of it. So a lot of things in the modern Israeli culture and modern Hebrew have their roots in ancient history and even in halachic practice. But I call upon him here, Maral is telling us he should know that at the time of Esther and Mordechai, that's when we started the concept of communal davening, right? And and also connected to the word kehillah. We're going to see later on in the Megillas Esther, it says, what did they do when it came to the 13th of Adar, what did they do? Nikalu v'amdu al nafsham. They fought. They fought, because the Pasuk says they actually ended up killing 75,000 fascists. In other words, the Jews ended up killing 75,000 followers of Haman. So it must have been a major battle. Probably took place, which clearly took place in many cities around the Persian Empire at the time. But it doesn't just say Amdu al Nafsham, which means they went into battle. It says Nikhalu for Amdu al Nafsham, which meant some of them went into battle, the others gathered together to daven. And that's the Kehillah. The Kehillah and the Beit Knesset are two intimately connected concepts. So if you have a look in the next paragraph of the Maharal, V'chein, can you see this, ladies and gentlemen, on page 3, the second paragraph, V'chein pirshu ha-Tosfos. And this is also brought down in the name of the Tosfos, of the medieval, of the Rishonim. This is brought down by the Rosh, Al-Masha Omru in Megillah Daf Beis, in other words, the very first page of Masechus Megillah. It says, Yom Shalosha Osa, on the 13th of Adar, which incidentally is today. Today's the 13th of Adar. Right? What happened on the 13th of Adar? Zman Kehilo Lakoli is a time where they all got together in Kehilos. They all got together in a Beit HaKnesset. And they got together to daven and to fast. And the fasting, if you listen to your shir before, and I didn't listen to your shir or Anthony Manning, but I'm sure he told you that one of the origins of Tanis Esther was because on the 13th of Adar, that was when they were fighting. That's when their lives were on the line. They were fighting hand-to-hand combat, and the rest of Klal Yisrael who weren't fighting were davening and fasting for them. That when we fight against, particularly we fight against Amalek, we need to fast. The tainis is part of the davening and part of the focus, that it's not appropriate where your fellow Jews are going to battle and you're sitting down and having a lovely lunch, having a big meal. Right? So the fasting and the davening was in order to unite Klal Yisrael. So look at what the Maharal here says. When the Gemara says that the 13th of Adar was a day of Kehillah Lakol, everyone got together, right? When we say the word Kehillah, we don't just mean getting together in order to have a good time or getting together to have a drink. We mean getting together lehispalel. Uvelosh ze sha'omro leich knosos kol yudim. And that was the message of Esther, that the Jewish people from now on, when they daven, they shouldn't daven alone at home. They should daven with a Kehillah. Mashma she'ikones osom yachad. That they should get them together. So here we have, I think it's a very fascinating idea here. And hidden behind, this is what I mentioned to you, that the Maharal sort of speaks about, in a sense, some of the more hidden backstory themes of the text when he deals with them. And this is a very good example of it, where Esther seems to be saying to Mordechai simply, get the Jews together and fast, and I'll go and risk my life. In actual fact, she's saying much more than that. She's saying davening should be done in a Beit HaKnesset, right? And it should be a Zman Kehillah, Nikhalu HaYehudim, that the Yehudim have to get together in communities, and that's the way to daven. And from then on, the Anshei Knesset Gedolah established the halacha of Tefillah B'Tzibur, which then became really, if you think about it for a minute, this period in history was the beginning of the diaspora, what we call the idea of a diaspora, that the Jews are living dotted all over the globe, all over the world, right? And in South America, and South Africa, and in New Zealand, and in Australia, and everywhere, and every planet, and in every part, in every country in the world, there are Jews living. How do they live? They live in kehilot. They don't live as individuals. They live all as part of a community. And the community focused around the Beit HaKnesset. So we're really, you could write a doctorate of sociology on this. The Jews, by instituting this mitzvah of Tefillah B'Tzibur, it restructured the whole social existence of Jews worldwide. From now on, a Jew had to live within walking distance of a Beit HaKnesset. He couldn't live out in the middle of nowhere by himself, because he would lose out on the Beit HaKnesset. Beforehand, before this mitzvah was given, a Jew could live in the middle of the countryside and get up in the morning and daven by himself and live a full Jewish life. But once the Chachamim said, Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, no, from now on you daven as part of a kehillah, of a kenoset kol ha-yudim, that changed radically Jewish life forever, right? And really preserved the ability of Jews to maintain a Jewish life, even under a very difficult circumstances. And I'm sure you're all familiar with the building of communities and the membership of communities, and communities give people a sense of identity. And all that was instituted in the Purim story by Esther Hamalka. Leich kenos es kol ha-yudim. That's what the... That what is instituted here at this point in the Megillah, and the Maral goes on to say, "V'zeh remez mash omer per kama de brachas." I'm now in the third paragraph of your text. In brachas davches, Rabbi Nosson Omer, minayin she'ena Kadosh Baruch Hu moes betfilatan shel rabim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will never reject the tefillah of rabim. Of a tzibur, of a group of people together. In other words, a person, the tefillah of an individual, right? So throughout the Tanakh, we find individuals davening. Avram davens, Moshe Rabbeinu davens, Yehoshua davens, David HaMelech davens. There's a lot of davening going on, but no one ever gets together with a group of people to daven together.
You don't hear about a minyan.
You don't hear about a minyan, yes. The idea of a minyan is created by the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. When you daven, you daven with a minyan, right? You need the minyan, and what is a minyan? A minyan is not just a group of people. It's a group of people united by their desire to pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Look at the last paragraph here of the Maharal on this page. It says, V'dayim, you should know, Ki Yisrael Bein Ha'umos, when the Jewish people are living among the nations, even if there are 1,000 of them gathered together in one place, right? They are still nikroim pazurim bein ha'umos. They're still considered to be scattered. If there's 1,000 of them, or 10,000 of them, if they get together to watch a football match, right? Or they get together to hear a concert, that's not yet called a knisa. That's not yet called a halachically, philosophically, spiritually, they're still considered to be pazurim bein ha'am. They are still scattered. Omnom kasha hayu mispalalim nikro tzibur. Only when they are davening together, it is the act of prayer which unites them together as a tzibur. Right, and the tzibur is called kashayim hem misasvim umiskaptim el Hashem yisparach, because by getting together to daven, right, they are all connecting to Hakadosh Baruch Hu uvaze yotzin bein ha'umos el Hashem, and at that moment, conceptually, says the Maharal, when you're davening b'tzibur, even if you're in Los Angeles. If you're davening b'tzibur, at that moment you're no longer in galut. You might be geographically in galut, but spiritually, right? Yotzim mibein ha'umas. At that moment, you have, if you like, separated yourself from the nations of the world, and you're no longer in Golus. Rav Yosef ben Soloveitchik, who went to places, says the idea of an embassy, right? The French embassy in England. So when you go into the embassy, it's as if you're in France. But legally, you consider if you're in France. So he would say that's the same thing about a Beit HaKnesset in New York or in Costa Rica, right, or in Johannesburg. Beit HaKnesset is in Eretz Yisrael. It's an embassy of Eretz Yisrael. When you stand in the tzibur, once a tzibur get together to daven, you're no longer mefuzar u'meforod bein ha'amim. So what the Maharal here is saying is very interesting. When Haman when Haman comes to the king and says, I want to destroy these people, he says, there is this people, and what are they? They are mefuzar umeforod bein ha'amim. They're scattered among all the nations, right? And therefore they are weak. Esther is saying, we have to solve this problem profoundly. We have to solve this problem by instituting a new mitzvah of a tefillah b'tzibur, of a kehillah coming together, and once they come together as a group in order to daven, at that point, right? At that point, they are no longer in galus. In that point, they're no longer mefuzar umefor beno amim. They are kenosis kol yudim. So you have here, if you like, this is two contrasting speeches given in our Megillah. Haman says, look, these people are mefuzar meforad. They're scattered and therefore they're weak. Esther says, kenosis kol yudim. Institute a way that they get together in order to give themselves some strength. And in that way, Tefillah B'Tzibur, the concept of Tefillah B'Tzibur was created. And that is, I think, a very interesting idea that the Maharal gives us on Megillas Esther.